Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 3rd. Sorry. There were some staff who was with us trying to write it down. Instead of third, it says thirst. I have to laugh. It is 2022. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m., and I'm the one that did the drafting. Today, we have President Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Hall, and myself, Chair Schauer. Senator Kawasaki, let me know he probably was not going to be here today. He had some previous commitments. I'd like to remind everybody to go ahead and turn off your cell phones, please, for the sound. Staff assisting Naresh with us from my office. We have Carrie from Senate Records and Alex behind us with the LAO. Four bills on today's agenda. We're going to introduce three. We're going to be taking public testimony on the governor's bill on election issues. First bill on the agenda is going to be Senate Bill 156, an act relating to COVID-19 immunization rights and relating to objection to the administration of the COVID-19 vaccine, introduced by Senator Reinbold. When you're ready, Senator Reinbold, are you going to take the you are? Okay, please take the table with you and your presenter. Put yourself on the record when you're ready, and we will begin. As a reminder for everyone, just for the policy, we're going to go with the Senate floor, which is if you're speaking, you're welcome to take the mask off. Just please kind of keep it up if you're just sitting there listening or in the room. With that being said, Senator Reinbold, you have floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and also members, Senator Holland and Senator Costello. Thank you for hearing this bill. I'm sure this is no surprise to you all, this bill. We've heard most of it over and over again on the Senate floor, so I'm not going to go and belabor the point too heavily. But I will tell you that I think everybody in the world has seen that the COVID vaccine can have implications worldwide, anything from losing jobs to immunity passports. I mean, it's just impacting across the world, COVID mandates. And the Supreme Court, thankfully, just voted in favor of freedom, more liberty, and individual sovereignty over your own body in regards to whether you're allowed to say no to or be required by an employer to have the vaccination to be employed. So basically what this does is SB 166, it's called Immunization Rights and the Relating to the Objection of the Administration of the COVID-19 Vaccine. As you all know, there's only one that is licensed, and I do not believe it is still commercially available in the United States. So pretty much every product that is being administered in the United States right now, I still believe is under EUA. Which is emergency use only, which that means it cannot be mandated. So just kind of a side note, but basically what this bill does is it prohibits discrimination. So basically the state or may not adopt or issue a regulation, an ordinance, or a policy that requires or mandates an individual to be vaccinated against COVID-19 to receive a public benefit that is already, that's available to the public. So basically, you can't be denied a benefit based on your vaccine status. And next, it ensures that the public is not discriminated based on their status. And it ensures a state agency or an employee of the state may not require an individual to produce documentations of their status or immunity passport to travel within the state. And I just want to make a side note here that the governor, I believe, has done an executive order on that already. Prohibiting vaccine passports. And this also allows an individual to object to the administration of a COVID-19 vaccine based on religious, medical, or other grounds. And parents or guardians may object to the administration of the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine, for their minor child based on medical or other grounds. So at a very, very, that's at a very high level an introduction to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. I'll just open it up to questions from committee members at this time. Senator Costello.
Thank you. So, Senator Reinbold, under on page 2, the very top section, so this would prevent a school district from requiring a vaccine in order for the child to attend public school. Can you just put that on the record?
This is absolutely that. So that I haven't done the sectional yet, but section 1809270 would be discrimination based on the vaccine status. So you couldn't force it, correct? You couldn't require mandate it. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Sorry about that. Just
oh internal. No, that's okay.
Not
that's
to the okay. question. Senator Costello, good on that. And I apologize because I actually had an internal discussion there. Could you repeat? I heard the question, but could you repeat the answer, Senator?
Well, I'm going to broaden this just a little bit through the chair, Senator Laura Reinbold, District G. Basically, I'm going to go a little bit more. logical in regards to this. Children are at a 99.9% for survival of COVID. They're at a very, very high level. And these COVID vaccines do not have long-term safety and health efficacy or long-term safety data in regards to them. So a lot of people are trying to push these on the children, and I would highly encourage people to go to the children's defense, and I'll have my staff in just a few moments speak about that. But basically, yeah, this does not, it allows a student to go to school, which they obviously should be. You cannot be denied a benefit that's available for the public or mandate it to get into school.
And Senator Ramble, just to be clear for the public record, this is, because I know there's a lot of people that talk about, and you see some of the counter, I mean, this issue has become one of the most divisive, hate-filled rhetoric, language, things I've seen almost in my lifetime, back and forth, regardless of which side you're on. One of the things that you will see is people talk about, well, you know, when did people stop, supporting the right of a business or a person to set their own policy in their private business? But delineating that here from what I read, just to confirm it for the record, you are specifically referring to a state agency, not a public, or excuse me, not a private entity like a business. Is that correct?
That goes later. I haven't gone through the sectional yet, but yes, you're allowed to make a recommendation, but you can't mandate it. You should not ever be able to mandate something that's experimental. I don't believe people should lose their individual liberties for work. And if the healthcare, you know, if they're not your doctor and you haven't informed, you know, decided with your physician to take any type of medical intervention, that's your relationship between you and your physician.
Okay, I'll ask the question again after you finish. Okay. That's fine. I think Senator Holland had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll probably just wait till a little further along on the presentation then.
Okay.
Okay, and if you want to expound, or did you want to go to Kelly for the sectional?
Oh, no? did you want to just talk about children's health defense for a moment? Okay.
Sorry. When you're ready.
Okay, so through the chair, Kelly Toth, thank you. Through the chair, Kelly Toth, Chief of Staff to Senator Reinbold, there are a couple of really good resources out there that speak directly to the reason for this bill and this section, particularly with children. The Children's Health Defense is a good resource that daily comes out with information regarding this. And also, just for the record, Senator Ron Johnson in Congress just had a listening session, and Dr. Malone was on record saying this must stop requiring vaccination. So it's a 5-hour listening session. There's a lot of good information there. Thank you.
Okay. So
questions, yep.
Okay. So through the chair, I put a 15-minute blurb on that 5-hour presentation up last night on my Facebook page, as well if people don't have a whole lot of time. But it was an outstanding hearing last week. So would you like me to go through the sectional, Mr. Chairman?
Right.
Okay. Okay, so section one, it's exercise of rights and access to benefits. A state agency or political subdivision may not, I've already gone over that, but basically you can't be denied a benefit that's available to the public based on your vaccine status. So section number two, an agency or an employee of the state or an agent of the state may not require an individual to produce documentation of the COVID-19 vaccination status or immunity passport to travel to or within the state. Next is discrimination based on vaccine status. So it's unlawful to discriminate for a person or government entity to refuse, withhold, or deny an individual or any local state services, goods, facilities, advantages, privileges, licensings, educational opportunities, healthcare access, or employment opportunities based on the COVID-19 vaccination status, whether an individual has a COVID-19 passport. You cannot bar an individual from employment or discriminate against the individual for compensation as a condition or privilege of employment or a public accommodation to exclude, limit, segregate, or refuse to serve or otherwise discriminate based on COVID-19 vaccination status or immunity passport. A recommended person, a government agency, or employer to receive a COVID vaccination is not unlawful. So you can recommend it. That is something you can urge or recommend, but you can't discriminate based on your vaccine status. And I'm going to just I'm just going to go on a personal few stories. I was in King County, Washington recently. I was also in Honolulu, Hawaii. And I know that Senator Kawasaki, who I was kind of wishing he was here today, because he was going to tell, you know, his potential, you know, his in New York. He was just in New York. You can't go into a restaurant without your little vaccine, you know, card. And it was really, really difficult for many, many people to travel. It's just, I've never seen such segregation in my life. And it was real, very, very real in several states in the nation. So we're just trying to prevent that kind of discrimination. The final section, you guys have seen this over and over again. It's an individual may object to the administration of the vaccine based on religious, medical, or other grounds. And as a parent or guardian of a minor, you can object to the vaccine based on religious, medical, or other grounds. And a person may not require someone to provide justification for their decision to decline the COVID-19 vaccine for a minor child.
Complete on that one?
I'm sorry?
Complete for the section.
Yeah, that's sectional. Comment? That is the sectional.
Okay. Questions so far? Go ahead, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I tell you, this is it's weird to see the requirements that are coming down from the federal government, coming down from the state government, coming down from private industry. And I was curious, just at a glance at this, I know someone who is going to be excluded from a federal event because they won't be able to produce a vaccine passport. This doesn't this just limits the requirement to produce a vaccine passport. It doesn't state anything about, okay, if they're going to have an additional requirement like producing a negative antigen test or something like that. This is just about the vaccine passports, correct?
You are correct.
Thank you.
So do you have a, this is more, it's because this is, except this is really, I mean, this is a worldwide issue. But for us here, I am cognizant of the fact of the argument that telling a private business, if they wish to do something, that we have to be careful because we don't want to trample their rights as well. If a business owner decides, I want to demand a, you know, a vaccine passport, or you can't come into my business, there is a fine line for us to walk between saying they can't do that, just as it is for somebody to say you have to have a vaccine passport to travel. So I understand that there are multiple arguments, which is why I wanted to have this open debate about it. At the same time, you know, when you look at the state level of requesting something like this, this gets into a really interesting grounds for why then, if we can require COVID-19 passport, why not the flu? Have you had your flu shot? Why not tuberculosis, right? Why not, have you had your hepatitis, depending on what they have in an area? Why not TB? Because I carry it positive from when I was like 18 years old. Maybe I have to have that with me. So how far down the rabbit hole do we go? Do you take the red pill or the blue pill and see where you wake up the next morning and what's happened to your society? So I understand that side of it too. That's why, like I said, I'm really interested to have this discussion as we go through it, because there certainly needs to be some, there needs to be decisions made on how far we can go with this, and when does people's personal private health information become everybody's business? When is it the government's right to step into a personal decision between a doctor and their patient? We've seen a lot of that, as you know, with the prescription of other alternative medications such as HCQ or ivermectin, where pharmacists are refusing to fill a doctor's legitimate order because they are inserting themselves into the process. So there are a lot of things here, Senator Rimbaud, that we need to be discussing and make determinations upon it. I will be interested to see some of the counter arguments that we might see through this process of the what would happen if you passed a law that told a business, or would it be, and I guess this is my question for you, constitutionally, have you discussed, I'm sure you have, and maybe a response to it, would there be a constitutional challenge to putting out a statement that says a business, a private business, not state, different thing to me, there's two kind of separate things there that we're discussing. Would a private business have a constitutional challenge to say you cannot demand that they don't request that if they so choose? Have you discussed that and have any thoughts for the committee?
Well, at a high level, I think the most important thing is individual liberties and individual sovereignties. I think that is of critical importance. In addition, natural immunity is far better, a lot of the new research is saying. But in regards to the private sector, the Supreme Court basically just ruled on that. In regards to the OSHA case in the big picture, I disagree with the part about healthcare workers, and I think that is going to be appealed. You know, or at least a new case is going to be brought. You know, in regards to that, but we are already in the state of Alaska. I'm just going to divert just a little bit.
One question, just before okay. you, please keep going. I'm not going to.
Okay.
I want you to finish the thought, but I just want to. Because this is the crux of one of the arguments with the Supreme Court, where it is, it says that OSHA can't force a company to force the mandate, the vaccine, you know, to get a vaccine, but they did not say that a company had to make a decision for or against it. In other words, they left it still up to the companies to have their own policy, but they did say the government, the federal government could not roll in with the big hammer, you know, and say, yes, you must. So that's why I'm curious, as you flesh this out, will there be, have you anticipated or talked about any possible constitutional challenges if a law was passed that said a private business, not state, but private, could not do something, because I wonder if we're going to end up in the same challenge. That's really what I'm talking. And if you don't have an answer, that's fine. That's one we definitely have to flesh out.
Yes, we absolutely, you know, I'll bring more research in regards to that. But I think the Constitution, you know, it basically tries to keep government in its lane. That's what the whole Constitution is for, keeping the federal government in their lane, keeping, you know, local and state government, and then everything else is reserved to the people and or you know, state sovereignty issues. And that's why I think it's so absolutely critical to get this into state statute, so we reserve this, because this isn't explicit. It's not for the federal government. So in my opinion, it is reserved to the individual, and then, you know, potentially for the state to address in regards to state sovereignty. I was going to say that one good thing that we have in state statute is right now, we are an opt-in state already. Nobody can force anything on anybody, including the masks. If they consider it a health device, it has to be a licensed healthcare provider, and that relationship is between you and your doctor. And that, if you've agreed to take something like, let's say, ivermectin, you know, that's between you and the patient and the physician to do, as well as You have the ability to say no to any and all. Every individual has the ability to say no to every single health intervention. Basically, we're an opt in state rather than an opt out state. Everybody's automatically opted out. So we have tremendous liberties in this state. We have very good statutes on the books as it is right now. This just clarifies, because there's been a lot of executive branch creep and, in my opinion, abuse of power in so many ways, and so we're just making sure that we preserve the individual freedom, the individual rights, and then state sovereignty as well. And I'm not sure if you'd like to add anything or if I'm missing anything.
At this time,
okay.
So it would be interesting, Senator Rand, but I'd like to have not now, but we can discuss it next week, perhaps. The Department of Law come on, because I would like to pose that question to them about the constitutionality, what they think. Just opinions, right? That's what lawyers are. It's always arguing opinions. I would be curious to see what they would say if you had one that said a private business could not do a certain thing. Because I want to know. I'm curious, because I think we had to have the debate. I don't disagree with you on individual liberty and all the precepts behind what you're doing, but I would like to be able to ask them that question, and perhaps even another expert testimony or two, and invite them in while we have this, where we can bring it up. Because your comment to the mass, like I said, we tried that in Ledge Council. You know, to make the point that, you know, if we're going to follow the science should work. And unfortunately, these do not work in the settings that we're in for this amount of time. Tried to make that point, it was shut down. So, you know, there's science, and if you want to follow science, that's fine. We should do that, but the science has to work. And unfortunately, what we're doing with these for this amount of time, we already know it's not going to work in the settings we're in. So we're not following the science. We're following the politics and the power play with a lot of this. I just want to make sure that whatever we do is going to sustain or withstand the challenges of the courts and both sides of the argument, so that we go through that. And I would like to hear that if we could get them, depending on the timeline and the next committee it goes to. So just something to consider for yourself as the bill sponsor and the committee, to entertain that argument and make sure that we are fleshing that out, because we should have that debate. Okay, Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, and I'll apologize to the world in general. I'm still new at this job. But so on page 2, line 24, a sentence starts off with a person may not require an individual. And I'm just curious, like on the previous page, line 11, instead of something like a person, you have a state agency, an employee of the state, or an agent of the state may not require an individual. Just as like potential amendment fodder, Is that something where instead of having a person there, it'd be more appropriate to have something a little more encompassing and say a state agency, employee of the state, or an agent of the state? That's an individual that may not require another individual to provide justification or documentation to support the individual's decision to refine. I'm kind of new at this law thing, but then again, we're in state affairs, aren't we?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, in that case, through the chair, we want it to be more generic because, like I'll tell you, like when I walked in, some Tom, Dick, or Harry in a restaurant was asking me for my PCR test or my vax card. So I'm just saying that's why we left it that way, because it's everywhere I was going in King County or in Honolulu, they were asking that to get in, even to the fast food type, you know, some of the fast food restaurants. It was really amazing the transformation that I've been witnessing in just such a short period of time. So in Alaska, we want to be free. If you want to, you know, choose to get the vaccination, that's your choice as long as you have informed consent. And also if you choose that natural immunity is the best, then that's the best. And I'm going to skip back to Senator Showers or Chair Showers' question in regards to the businesses. I just think that is such an absolutely important that you need a license, a healthcare license, to be telling people what to do or making that decision between the patient and the doctor. An employer should not be telling you, you need to go do this and you need to go do that. And I mean, that is a very, very slippery slope. They're not licensed healthcare providers. And I personally don't believe that they have rights to dictate what I do to my body and what is required, you know, what kind of injection I need to have a body to be able to work there. I can't fathom that. I just, to me, it's clear as day, but I understand we can get the Department of Law, but if they don't have a license, you know, or the, you know, to practice medicine, they should not be interjecting themselves there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the concern I have is it seems like it's pretty clear cut when we talk about what are we going to try to limit the state from doing. And I'm not quite sure why some non-state individual would have some investment in wanting to know the justification of why a person may decline the COVID vaccine. But I just wonder if this goes into restricting non-state entities. And I'll just look at that a little harder before we get to the amendment part of all this, see if there's a way to go. Thank you.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, I just wanted to make sure that for an example, like what Senator Cassell was bringing up, like if your child, you were signing up for school and they wanted, you know, they were pushing this, and they could say based on religious reasons, medical or other grounds, no, I would not like to. A lot of people were wanting to, you know, prove it, show it, you know, even at Providence. I mean, it was all over the place, these different forms, many broad forms, and they were forcing people to tell them why and what their religious beliefs were and digging deep into their psyche. And it was, I couldn't even believe the forms that were being sent to me. So that's why it just gives them liberty, and then they couldn't get interrogated, basically. And that's the reason why that's in there.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So again, Senator Ramble, like I said, I go back to that. You said a slippery slope. I said, quite frankly, with COVID, we're in a slippery barber pole. We're straight down going maximum speed here into the twilight zone. Because there are things we have to be careful of, and I know there will probably be court challenges from, you know, depending on how this is laid out. Because again, just like you said, nobody should have the right to tell you what you can and can't do with your body, et cetera. You know, my body, my choice, all the things we've heard for years. It is also that's the one area I think we have to be careful of stepping on, is if somebody says, well, this is my business, you stay out of it. You can't tell me what to do. It's a tough place to be, because it is kind of both sides of the coin of telling a business owner what they can do with their own business, their own money, their own sweat and blood. Well, no, you can't tell me I can't demand a certain thing. That's kind of where we are at the courts. There's some challenges going through that. Like I said, the OSHA versus what they're doing, pulling the federal mandate, but not telling a private entity what they can and can't do. So that's why I'm curious to have a little bit more of a discussion about it. Back to the private data you talked about, I will circle back and say that if you have a, like you talked about, private health data, where you go up and somebody says, I want to see your data. Just to walk into a store, we know it's happening in places around the world. We're saying, well, you can't come shop here. You can't get groceries. You can't buy, you know, you can't buy gas. You can't do whatever. Well, that's getting into a different territory, right? Because now there are private individuals that are asking you for your data. They're not licensed. They're not doctors. They don't really have a right to that data, but they're demanding it. So that's back to that slippery slope concept, right? There is a fine line probably walking here, and it's going to balance back and forth. And so I see both sides of it, at least related to always respecting a private individual's right to do what they think is best, including the data, including not going to how many, you know, how far down that rabbit hole do we go of, I want to know everything about your health before I let you in my business, to also making sure we don't step across lines that we're going to find. And again, I go back to a constitutional challenge on the other side that says, well, no, you can't demand that. So I'm just curious where that line is. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. Not my area of expertise. I just want to have that debate so we kind of talk about it and see. Because I think that speaks to our intent, too. What is the intent of the legislature with legislation like this to guarantee? And as you said, it's a lot of it. This is about individual rights and making sure those are protected and not stepped on all sides. So anyways, if you have a response, that's fine. I just want to throw that out because there were some, this is a, this is kind of the thing of our time right now, quite frankly.
Well, the data is coming out more and more and more. And if you look at the DOD data and you look at the Israeli data where the COVID vax was pushed very, very, very heavily, there is some tremendously concerning data that's coming out. And if you look at the hearing of Senator Ron Johnson last week, they're exposing it to global alliances. There's a Canadian one. But I will always lean on individual liberties, absolutely above a profit-making. And this really goes into what's open to the public. If your business is open to public, we already have tremendous rules on not discriminating based on race and origin and religion and all that. There already are a lot of things in place. This is, again, you know, individual sovereignty over your own body. And natural immunity is just being completely ignored in many, many places. It was being ignored in Honolulu, Washington State, New York. And I find that just even Canada was honoring a minimum of 6 months of natural immunity. So in the United States, for some reason, they're not. And I especially with this new mRNA technology, that's why when I looked at the research back from 2001, 2, 3, and 4, there was tragic outcomes with the mRNA technology. And that's why as a person that used to be working in the pharmaceutical industry, I was just red flags immediately up on new therapy because I've seen what's happened over and over and over again with huge risks. And to think that someone has to choose between their job and you know, taking in basically in America an experimental mRNA type vaccine that doesn't have the long-term safety and efficacy, I thought it was just horrible that people should not be forced in a position where they have to choose, you know, when they don't know the long-term safety and efficacy over their job. And I can't tell you how many dozens upon dozens, even hundreds of people between our listening sessions, we've heard that this has completely destroyed their livelihoods. And it's a very, very, very serious issue. And I do think it deserves it, but I'm always going to err on the side of individual liberties.
So I appreciate if we could do, perhaps, like I said, the next committee hearing, if we can bring Department of Law and any other experts you'd like and have a little more discussion to flush this out. I'm most interested in that, the line between a private company and the state entity, because the state is within our right to do exactly what you're saying. I don't have any problem with that at all, and we need to be careful of that. I want to find out where that line may exist for a private company, just like forcing a private citizen to do something. You bring up an interesting point, which goes back to when OSHA, and I've been saying this from the beginning, I said, if you're a business owner, you are an absolute fool if you are forcing people or coercing them, in essence, by potentially losing their job to get shots they don't want, because we know there's adverse reactions up to and including death. Bayer says it's well over 20,000 and over a million of adverse reactions, at least. That's the numbers we saw a few weeks ago. I just posted a letter from a lawyer in the lower 48 who's been in this battle since the very beginning. He's about a 40-something-year lawyer down south that's very experienced. And in that letter, it talks about the fact that while you cannot what's the right word? I don't want to use it. I'm not a lawyer. But you cannot basically force the private company to have that policy either way. The company should understand that they are at risk if under the threat of coercion, essentially, an employee takes a vaccine knowing that there could be an adverse reaction up to and including death, putting them on the hook for it, which is why I go back to what I've said from the beginning. Until this is fully adjudicated in the courts and we have better data, because that's the other part I think a lot of people were most concerned is we normally have, and you know this, we briefed and talked about it, you know, 7 to 9 years to bring shots, vaccines online so you have good efficacy data on what the impacts might be. And we did this in less than a year. And so I think a lot of people have resistance because they're concerned. We know there's adverse reactions. So what liability, culpability will those businesses have? And I contend it's going to be big because there's a lot of people that own businesses that were pushing these things, and they're going to find themselves liable for the damages to people's lives. So it's a dangerous place to be. That's not my decision. It's not a state thing. I'm just saying I don't think it was very wise of businesses to put themselves out on a limb like that, because the federal government's going to saw that limb off and say, sorry, not our fault. And they've already said you can't go after, you know, the pharmaceutical company. So you're looking at a business going, well, now what are you going to do? You put yourself here. Got to be careful about it. So that's a different discussion. But it's kind of germane to this process of how we got here. And so I'll keep it open to the committee because I would like to have that furthering discussion with those other maybe panel experts, if you want to call it that, to flesh out that line on this, if we could do that, but open to other questions at this time. No? Yes? Is that what that means? Knock, knock.
I'd like your attention, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Put your hand up. Hit me. Go ahead. Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, yeah, I hear Mr. Chairman often talking about devil's advocate, and I believe it's important that people have I have family and friends across the spectrum, and I respect all of their choices from totally not vaccinated to double vaccinated and boosted, and that one caught COVID. You know, it's I'm vaccinated. I caught COVID early this year. So I just worry about what can we do as a state and what can we require of individuals. And so I see, like, on the top of page two, this is a lot easier when it was just one page, when it's just the first page. Yes. The second page gets really curious. But the top, if you read it, it's unlawful discrimination for, say, a person to deny an individual a local service such as enrollment in a private school. And so if someone has a private daycare or school or something like that, I just wonder I'd be interested in hearing what the legal thoughts would be on this. I don't know that we are there yet where we can. I think it's a much easier argument to say what can we enforce from the state level as opposed to what can we enforce from the in the private sector, and that we make the arguments we can make the easy arguments first and then have discussions on the more complex issues later. But that's just a thought. I don't even know if there's a question in there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I say you're rambling now? Sorry, it was from committee yesterday. It's kind of funny. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so I have a comment, and I believe my staff may have a comment as well. Again, Senator Reinbold, District G. Bottom line, I think it's just very, very, very important. Are you going to require, you know, there's probably 100 vaccines in the big picture. Does that mean you can require someone to take all of them? I just believe it's a very, very, very slippery slope. And when things are open to the public, like schools are open to the public, businesses are open to the public, you know, that needs to be an individual liberty thing. I'm a huge believer. If you want to take it, that's your choice. But if you don't want to take it, it should be your choice too. You should not be discriminated on, especially the research is coming out very, very strongly with natural immunity. It would be far, far better. Even I believe the last data I looked at was the Pfizer vaccine is down to 20%. It would have never gotten approved. And then now, I mean, even in the VAERS data, I think it's almost 22,000 deaths, over a million side effects. And they estimate that to be 10% of reality. And that's the experts, not me. That's the experts. I mean, you think about that, and you tenfold that. I mean, it's pretty, pretty alarming, and I think we're just on the tip. And to think that you're going to tell someone you have to be involved in this new, you know, type, which is this mRNA therapy, to come into my business or to work for me, I can't even fathom that. It just doesn't even seem possible, logical, scientific, anything. Getting involved in one's healthcare and healthcare decisions to walk into my business center, what are they going to do? Herpes next. I mean, you know, it just could be AIDS. It could be, you're just going down a very, very slippery slope. There's already 7 coronaviruses. I mean, are you going to check for all these other, you know, 1,000 diseases that are out there? I just think it's a super bad idea. It's extraordinarily dangerous slope.
Like I said, Senator Ram, but I think we need to discuss this. There's some interesting things here. I'm curious to have that debate with the other folks we talked about. And that also leads me to what happens every time we pass a law, if it's a good one. What will our courts do? I'm more worried about the Alaska courts, not necessarily the U.S. Supreme Court, but I am concerned about that too, because I know how they tend to act on certain things and where they fall more towards, you know, a spectrum of the decisions we've seen of them, how they override what we do. So, and we cannot make law based on what we think they're going to do, but I want to see from legal experts that think about it where we might be at a line that how that may impact what they're thinking on it. So it's just a fascinating discussion that we need to do. So, I have no more questions at this time. Anybody else in the committee? Senator Reinbold, go ahead if you have a follow-up or a closing argument.
Well, there's. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back and we'll be able to
talk
about this. But I will tell you, there's a few dozen cases out there, and they have strongly been in favor of individuals and individual liberties. So I will tell you, we have a big stack of them. We haven't had a chance to read all of them, but they are extremely good. And I think in general, they're very, very good. And I will also tell you that the tip of the iceberg in regards to the long term, it's just starting to come out. I mean, what these are, there's serious concerns with potential long term side effects in regards to this. And that's why I want to err on the side of caution as well, so we get the long term. And that's why we kept this to the COVID-19. We didn't broaden it. We kept it very narrow in regards to this, because this ends up being one of the most disruptive issues of our time. I mean, there's issues across the nation. Look at what's happening right now at the border, at the Canadian-Alaska border. You're supposed to get a vaccine, whether you've had COVID or not. You might have far superior mode, but you can't get through that border and travel freely based on that. And I mean, it's just unfathomable to me what's happening. And that's why go Convoy 2022 to Ottawa. So I'm really happy to come back and have the discussion. We will also have some legal experts as well, because I think Department of Law, you know, maybe their perspective is good. But we are the legislature, and I think we need to make sure. I don't think that everything that the executive branch does, they come and check in on us. Is this okay with you guys? Or the judiciary, is that okay with you guys? Sometimes we need to exercise our legislative muscle and do what we need to do. And I think on this issue, we have the public, you know, the public on our side in regards to this, the vast majority of them. So, you know, that would be just from what we're seeing out there. People they want it available, but they don't want it mandated.
Understood. And like I said, I'm all about the debate, and you are welcome back. We'll talk to you afterwards as far as the ability to when we schedule this next week and when you can get the appropriate folks here. And like I said, I don't rely on one. I don't trust anyone. This is the Ronald Reagan Trust But Verify on just virtually everything, which is why I like to have people from all sides. Before you leave the table, Kelly, can you just, for the record, talk to the fiscal note just so we have it out there, please, very briefly? I know it's zero. I just want to make sure it's on the record and it's spoken to.
I don't think we've had one.
I have it here if you'd like it.
I didn't.
We weren't given a copy.
Just step up. I'll give it to you, and you can just talk to it if you want. I'd just rather you do it than us. That way it's official.
Mr. Chairman, Kelly Toth, for the record, Chief of Staff, Senator Reinbold. The fiscal note here for SB 156 is a zero fiscal note.
Okay, thank you very much. I know that's just a little formality, but we'll get it done. At this time, Senator Reinbold, you guys can clear the table. Thank you very much for this, and we'll talk about bringing you back soon, quickly, so we can get the other folks. We're going to set this bill aside. If anybody has amendments for this for now, I'd like to have them to our office by Monday, 7th February, next week, close business, and we'll bring this bill back up as soon as possible. It could be Tuesday. It might be Thursday next week. We'll play that based on availability of presenters. Second bill is going to be SB 142, an act relating to the sovereignty of state elections, constant theme today. Introduced by myself, we're going to invite Mr. Scott Ogan, my senior policy advisor, to the table. He's going to help us present the bill. What I'm going to do is start off with the sponsor statement, and then Mr. Ogan will give us the sectional analysis, and we'll ask questions as we go. Just please feel free to stop me. So this time it's Senate Bill 142. It is an act relating to the sovereignty of state elections. As everybody here kind of knows, I've been working on elections for some time. Nothing new. Why are we hearing back? Oh, that got hit to play. Can somebody hit pause? That makes sense now.
No, that's green.
I think that it may still go, though, unless they hit stop. I don't know where that. There's a pause right button lower left for you.
The bottom left, pardon me. Yeah.
That's okay. I'll let it go. People might as well see. No, go to the lower left of the.
That's another way.
That's one way to do it.
That is one way to do it.
Should I close it out?
Just leave it. Well, that's fine. We'll get to it. Sometimes they should see how screwed up things can be on the state level, too. We don't want to hide that. We're transparent here, right?
Aren't we?
So last year, Congress passed House Resolution 1 in the House, but failed in the Senate. They didn't have the votes to break the filibuster. So for now, it remains stalled in Congress. H.R. 1 federalizes state elections and foists constitutionally questionable federal mandates upon the states, overriding long-honored state election procedures. Congress has the constitutional authority to manage certain aspects of federal elections. Article 1, Section 4, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. The relationship between states and the federal government has been long and cooperative. By and large, states need their federal representatives elected, and we have the staff, voting system, and roles of who is a resident and further prescribes what qualifies a voter. In return, the federal government enjoys utilizing the low-maintenance state election system to elect our federal delegates. Today, many states, including Alaska, are working to restore confidence in the election system. The last 5 years have shaken the confidence of many Americans in our election process across the political spectrum. In a gross overreach, the federal government is attempting at this time to foist a one-size-fits-all approach with H.R. 1 by mandating federal policy nationwide versus the longstanding practice of letting states set policy and manage their own elections. We've heard fake cries of putting people in chains and Jim Crow-type election laws from the highest levels of government, including the president himself and members of Congress. Divisive and virtue-signaling language from elected officials does not help us solve the problem that Americans have with the shaking confidence in our election system. We are asked on a daily basis for ID to prove who we are in nearly every aspect of our lives. Asking a voter to prove they are a United States citizen, a resident of a state, or to positively identify themselves as prudent and reasonable. Verifying a person's identity and eligibility to vote is sound policy. It's why we're asked for ID for nearly everything we do of any significance on any given day. Voting is one of the most sacred and important actions we take as citizens. Who we elect and what those officials do affects us at every level of our lives. A congressional policy of not showing identification to vote is a clear and present danger for our republic. We believe because the state legislatures formally gave up the power to choose our own senators, the states are justified with a fight to retain strong control of how they are elected by the people. The 17th Amendment repealed this provision of the Constitution, and afterward the states prescribed the procedures of the people, not the legislatures, electing their senators to represent them. If the federal government nationalizes the election system, undermining the long tradition of mutual cooperation or worse, the sovereign rights of a state to maintain and manage its internal election affairs, then Alaska should simply tell the federal government to run their own election, essentially bifurcating the election process. Doing so will require the federal government to create its own exhaustive system of voter rolls, voter qualifications, tabulators, reporting, counting, recruiting and training volunteers, and a myriad of other details which are expensive and difficult to manage without the state's cooperation. In short, Congress should think long and hard about the unintended consequences of mandating federalization of elections upon sovereign states, and should be reminded it was the states who originally delegated their powers to the United States, the 10th Amendment. This bill will rescind a portion of that delegated authority. And as just a generic comment, as the bill sponsor, remember, it's kind of what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Those that right now may be touting House H.R. 1 might say that this is great because we have the presidency and we have Congress and, you know, we have the Senate and the House and they enact those regulations, that law. However, what happens when there's the red wave and now the other party has the presidency and the House and the Senate and they take that very same thought process and law and go the other direction? People that are supporting it now would be squawking about it then. We've seen this back and forth. Our point to this is you need to be careful about what you enact as a law because it can affect both sides as a double-edged sword. We believe the best approach is you leave it the federated system that we have always had. What works in New York City does not work in Alaska. What works in Alaska does not necessarily work in Texas or Hawaii. And having bureaucrats and politicians in Washington, D.C., from different places across the country trying to mandate that one-size-fits-all approach is not the best way to govern. It was federated for a reason. The founding fathers of the nation saw that you would have different areas of the country that would have different requirements. It is very different in Oklahoma and Kansas for farmers and what they require from their representatives and how things work than it is in a huge city like Los Angeles or New York. So that is the intent of the bill from the sponsor, myself, and the reason that we believe this is something we need to pass to protect states' rights, up to and including bifurcating the election system to require the federal government to do it themselves if they're going to force this down upon us without giving us a choice. And with that being said, I will take any questions at this time. And if there are none, I'll go over to Mr. Ogan for a sectional analysis. Well, that was easy. Mr. Ogan, put yourself on the record, please, and you may begin with sectional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott Ogan. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor to Senator Mike Schauer. Senate Bill 142 only has one section. In Section 1, it adds a new section that authorizes Division of Election Director, to determine when a federal election law is inconsistent with the provision of our elections and regulations and requires the division to stop administering federal elections, but allows them to carry on allows the director to carry on with state office elections. Furthermore, Section 1 bans an agency, employee, or an agent of the state or a municipality from expending funds for the aforementioned activity. Additionally, Section 1 lets the federal government administrate its own elections.
Questions on the sectional analysis? Senator Costello?
Thank you. So my question has to do with if this were to pass and become law and an election is stopped, the fiscal note indicates there's no fiscal note. So would a subsequent election be handled where Alaska voters have the ability to vote for the president and the federal offices?
Mr. Chairman, Scott Ogan, that's a question it's hard to imagine. There's constitutional obligations to conduct the elections, right? So I think it would be very difficult for the federal government to conduct its own election. I mean, they would have to set up their own system for doing it. And right now they're dependent on the state system. So I think it might create a little bit of the constitutional crisis if they aren't prepared to do a federal election. It would be pretty interesting to see. They'd have to figure out how to get it done. And that would be a pretty formidable task.
Senator Costello, I'll jump a little bit. This is one of the things that came out last year with a number of roundtable discussions, including some long-standing organizations that have been looking at this for decades. One of the answers they had, this is not the first time this has come up, this is a repeating issue that you will get from time to time from the federal government on changing election law and potentially forcing things down states' throats that they don't want. And so, and remember, like I said, this can work either way, right? This could be a blue state, a red state. People should be very skeptical of the federal government forcing states to do anything they don't want to do, because it really is. It could be a red president, a blue president. I mean, it shouldn't matter, right? Both sides could be affected. Our goal with this is to look at the federal government and go, don't tell us how we're going to run our elections. We're going to do it the way we want to because we're Alaska. And every other state should feel the same impetus to tell the federal government, leave us alone to run it. As Mr. Ogan has said, one of the answers that we got from this as a potential method to keep the federal government from trying to enact this is to have states go, if you want to do this, you must run the election yourself. There is still a requirement. They would have to run an election. But as Mr. Ogan said, they would be forced to spend the money, spin up the system. They would have to do all the things the states normally give them. They still are required to do that. That was our understanding of this. So what we're forcing here is a message to say, if you're going to do this, you're going to have to spend the money. You're going to have to spend the time. It's going to be a nightmare for you to do this. There's a reason there's a federated system. It works. We have a symbiotic relationship. If you're going to destroy that symbiotic relationship and tell us it's a one-way street, well, we've got news for you. You're not going to use our resources to do it. It's one of the ways we're fighting back on a number of issues from federal supremacy of saying, you can do what you want, but we're not going to help you. We're not going to give you state resources to do it, which makes it very hard for them to take this path. And so the answer, Senator Costello, as we have been told so far, and I will certainly be glad to bring back, maybe some other legal experts and discuss it further, is that it is a requirement and they would have to do that. It's not a path they want to go down, which is why we're applying this as a pressure point and going, if you really want to do this and force it on us, you've got a lot more work to do, and it's going to cost you money and time and effort to do it, and I don't think they're prepared to do it, which makes it an interesting challenge if it was to go to the courts. I hope that at least somewhat answers your question. Senator Pollin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, 3 points. First, we might have identified a new revenue stream for Alaska, subcontracting elections out of the federal government. Second, is this being pursued in any other state successfully at this time?
Senator Holland, I'm going to ask Mr. Ogan, because we got this last year, we would have to ask those other organizations that suggested this as a policy path. I know other states were investigating it. To your specific question of successfully, I don't know where they are unless Scott has a forthright answer. We'll probably have to get back to you on the successful part of that for what has happened.
Mr. Chairman, we'll circle back on that one.
Okay, we'll have to circle back because I didn't think we had a specific answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The third point would be, do we have an opinion from, like, Department of Law or alleged legal?
We did not invite them today as this was just the initial hearing, but we will for the next time. So we'll bring them back and we'll have the larger discussion because we will need to have that. And we're going to need to get a couple answers as well from the good questions we anticipated we'd have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, Senator Reinbold, did you have a question? None? Okay, I think, thanks, Scott. I think you can clear off the table.
Sure.
We don't, I guess I could talk to the fiscal note on this one just so it's on the record since it is our bill. Currently, it is a zero fiscal note for this. It requires the Division of Elections to cease administering federal elections. I'll just read it. If the director determines that the federal government has enacted a measure relating to voter registration or conduct of elections that is inconsistent with Alaska state election laws, passage of this legislation will have no financial impact on the division because we're still going to run our elections no matter what. So nothing would answer was nothing should be elected on our part. It would be a federal government responsibility. Okay. Let's see. I believe at that time, does anybody have any further questions for this particular bill? All right. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside at this time. If anybody has amendments for now, they're going to be due to the office by next Wednesday, 9 February, closed business. We plan on bringing the bill back up after that, and we will have some expert testimony and legal on board to discuss the questions that were asked. It will take public testimony at that time as well. Going to move on to the next bill. Third bill today is House Bill 148. Act relating to the Alaska Coordinate System of 2022, and all the technical aspects will definitely be answered by Representative Shaw, according to what he told me. He understands this intimately well. So when you're ready, sir, you have the table. You know the drill. Please put yourself on the record, and I think we have to bring your presentation back up for the real technical side, but when you're ready, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Laddie Shaw, District 26, South Anchorage. I want to take this opportunity to thank DNR for bringing this bill to my office, as well as Laura Ogan Bubenshine for her invaluable assistance. If I may, would I be allowed to offer some highlights from the sponsor statement? This is not a complicated bill, but phonetically, it can be that way. The updated 2022 datum and Alaska coordinate system will greatly improve accuracy, eliminate known issues, and provide Alaskans an easy system to share positioning data and access to the National Spatial Reference System. The new gravity-based elevation system will dramatically improve the ability to measure elevations in Alaska, which is ideal for climbing and flying off mountains. This modernization effort will benefit scientists, surveyors, design professionals, geographic information system specialists, and geospatial community personnel. My apologies. I encourage you to support the passage of HB 148 as it is critical to Alaska's maintaining accuracy to surveying and mapping. And with that, I pass the rest of this presentation off to my staff, Reese Williams. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Just before you go, Reese, I have to, because we're laughing and there's a little bit here, so understand that the conversations Laddie and I have, this is the system itself, when you get to the base, is very complicated and how it works, but this is kind of an ongoing joke that we're like, we understand this. This is perfectly, it's easy, it's really not. So just so that the public understands why we're looking at each other and laughing a little bit, that's the history behind this one, because it is it's a bill that we often launch, but we don't really understand the technical parts of what it does, because anyways, and I use it too, and I know the modern world with jumping off mountains, that's an appropriate comment, because I think we see that occasionally around Juneau. There's some legislator flying over our heads on the weekends in a parachute or something.
And Mr. Chairman, what we want to do is try to be crystal clear.
Yes, sir. Of course. Restart when you're ready. Oh, and by the way, I should add, apologize. You do have public testimony. We have Jake Maxwell on the line as well as Will Webb, and I think we have Gwen Gravalis here just to answer questions. Is that correct?
Yep.
So if we need them as a lifeline or when their time comes, just let me know. And please continue.
For the record, my name is Reese Williams, staff representative Shaw. Thank you, Chair Schauer, and members of the committee, this opportunity to present House Bill 148. And despite the complicated name, HB 148 is actually very simple. All we're looking to do is revise Alaska Statute Chapter 38.20, known as the Alaska Coordinate System, to reflect changes in the upcoming federal-state plane coordinating system of 2022, and to allow for future updates. So earlier the representative mentioned the federal datum, and I think the biggest question is, what is a datum? It's the most complicated part of the bill. So a geodetic datum, or simply a datum, is a tool used to define the shape and size of the Earth, as well as the reference point for various coordinate systems used in mapping it. Datums are used in navigation, mapping, as well as satellite navigation systems. The most recent federal datums were the North American Datum of 1983, the North American Vertical Datum of 1988. So it's been a little while since it's been updated. A good explanation for datums off of the NOAA website is, datums act like starting points when you give someone directions. For instance, when you tell someone how to get to your house, you give them a starting point like they know, such as a crossroads or building address. That's really what a datum is. We have a helpful video from the NOAA website that we'll play right now and hopefully make it a little bit clearer.
They turned the volume down. I believe they turned the, Mr. Chairman, I think they turned
it. Can you hear it? Yeah. We were hearing it before it started autoplaying on us.
Yeah, one moment. There we go.
Perfect. Just start it over. We'll be good.
Surveying today relies heavily on the Global Positioning System, GPS, or similar systems from other countries, collectively known as Global Navigation Satellite Systems. Today's satellite-based technology can help people determine accurate positions and elevations more efficiently than in the past. The benefits of using GPS to determine accurate positions and elevations will be even greater when NGS defines new datums. Take a look at the planned new datums and some of their expected benefits. Horizontal positions are currently defined by the North American Datum of 1983, or NAD83. This will be replaced by a new geometric datum, which provides latitude, longitude, height, and time information. Vertical positions, or elevations, are currently defined by the North American Vertical Datum of 1988, or NADD88. This will be replaced with the new vertical or geopotential datum. The new datums will help lessen the impact of aging physical infrastructure, like marks, that currently help define NAD83 and NADD88. The new geometric datum that will replace NAD83 will rely completely on reference stations that continuously receive GPS information. MGS maintains the CORS network, which stands for Continuously Operating Reference Stations. Users can reference CORS to help accurately determine any geometric position, which includes latitude, longitude, and some elevation information. CORS provides elevation information computed using an ellipsoid model of the Earth. An ellipsoid can be used as a rough approximation of the shape of the Earth. However, we know that the Earth is not shaped like a perfect ellipsoid. As a result, we need another model, one that reflects the varied topography of the Earth, including features such as mountains and valleys. This new model, called a geoid, is based on the variations in gravity across the Earth's surface. The geoid model is the basis for the new vertical or geopotential datum. This new datum will combine the ellipsoid height and the geoid height at the same point to calculate its elevation. To help improve accuracy of the new vertical datum, NGS is completing a major project called Gravity for the Redefinition of the American Vertical Datum, or GRAVD. NGS is flying over the entire U.S. and collecting a unique continuous gravity data set that will help us build a better geoid model, which will improve the accuracy of elevation measured using GPS technology. When the new datums are adopted, positioning information for existing structures and marks will change. The scale of the change will vary depending on your location, ranging from 0.5 to 1.5 meters in a horizontal direction and 0 to 1.2 meters in elevation. These changes, based on our newest positioning technology and scientific knowledge, will provide more accurate positioning information, They will have impacts in areas ranging from transportation, construction, floodplain mapping, agriculture, and more. Even though the change is years away, the time to prepare is now. While tools will be available to facilitate the transformation of specific physician information, they can take years to change products, services, or databases. You may want to begin examining current databases and records that may be impacted and plan for the effort required to update. In addition, many states and other governmental entities pass laws requiring that public works or MAPs reference NAD 83 or NAD 88. Those laws or contracts will need to be changed to reflect the new datums. Starting to plan now will help you be well positioned for the change. Resources are available and continue to be developed by NOAA's National Geodetic Survey.
Hopefully that video would have cleared up any questions anyone had.
Crystal clear. Absolutely crystal clear. Understood every part of it.
And
I
so,
will say this though, Representative Shaw, after watching that, that makes basically at this point ranked choice voting. Oh boy. So this is simpler than that, if that tells you anything. I understood that better than I understand ranked choice voting. Please continue.
So by incorporating new federal datum, we're going to make sure the state is prepared to make full use of the latest, most accurate technology for surveying and mapping, among other things. The importance of this bill is highlighted by the upcoming deadline of this new system, which is March of this year. It's the 2020 datum, as well as the fact that we have billions of dollars in infrastructure money coming in. We're going to want to be able to use these new datums for all of that. As I should be clear, now I'm not a geodesist, and this is not my particular area of expertise. Fortunately, we have some people online to help me out. Gwen Gervailis, Chief Surveyor and State Geodetic Coordinator, as well as Jake Maxwell from the Alaska Society of Professional Land Surveyors, and Will Webb from the Alaska Professional Design Council. Our office would like to thank everyone online, as well as the Department of Natural Resources for assisting with this legislation. That's all I have. I'm available for questions. Do you have any?
I do not. Do you want to just briefly, and you don't have to belabor the point, but on the sectional analysis and fiscal note, just so that we've got it for the record, please?
Yeah. Sectional analysis for HB 148. Section 1 amends AS 38.20.010 to add a reference to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Alaska Coordinate System 2022.
And Reese, you're welcome to summarize them. Read them. It's okay. I know it's a long presentation with a lot of technical things. Not trying to rush you. Do what you want, but you don't have to read it word for word. That's fine. If you want to give us the highlights.
Yeah. So really, we're just adding language into statute that will allow us to incorporate the new datum because it's in statute now. And until we change the statute, we're not able to incorporate. So that's really the push for it right now. And that's really what the section goes through. We're just adding it in order to update it. And we do have a zero fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you. And I think at this time you want to go to your expert testimonies. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think they're both. We've got a couple people for public invited testimony. And Gwen's really available for questions for the most part.
Not planning on public testimony today, just for the invited for the next time in case we have a memo. So we'll start with Jake Maxwell. Are you online?
Hello, through the chair. Appreciate you taking the time for our testimony. My name is Jake Maxwell through the Alaska Society of Professional Land Surveyors. Mr. Williams did a great job summarizing the bill already. This amendment is needed because public and private entities cannot operate and support this new system unless it's codified in the law. It's expected that every state will adopt a similar bill to update their system. As well, currently Washington and Kentucky have passed similar legislation and several other states have pending bills as well. This is part of developing a modern, more functional statewide coordinate system for mapping, designing of land, infrastructure, and resources. This bill adds the 2022 system to the systems, the 1927 and 1983. The 2022 system uses space-based and gravity measurement to vastly improve over previous systems. Since the many original oil leases are based on the 1927 and other work relies on the 1983 systems, adding the 2022 to state statutes allows users to use any system necessary. Thank you.
Thanks, Jake. Any questions for Jake? Okay, we're going to go over to Will Webb at this time. Will, if you can hear us, go ahead with your who you are, who you represent, and your testimony, please.
Chair Schauer, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Will Webb. I'm the current president of the Alaska Professional Design Council, and we are a nonprofit corporation that represents the common interests of Alaska's design professionals. Our members include engineers, land surveyors, landscape architects, and interior designers that live and work throughout the state of Alaska. We're in support of this House bill to add the 2022 coordinate system to state law because, frankly, our industry benefits a lot when we can interoperate with across projects, across disciplines, and with different clients. So by incorporating this updated coordinate system, we're able to both take advantage of the latest survey technology and continue to work with our clients to better incorporate the data that we can get from all the different sources, whether it's city, state, federal, wherever. By having this common coordinate system, it allows us to take advantage of all the public resources available. So we, as a group, urge your support in passing this bill.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Webb? Okay. At this time, I believe actually, it's kind of funny, Representative. I understand this a little more than I lead on to because of how we targeted the military stuff that we were doing. So I kind of get it, but it is funny for us to have this, what? I don't know what you're talking about conversation. So do you have any further comments or closing at this time?
I do, just a minor closing. For us to have an understanding of the geopotential datum relative to the ellipsoid model makes a huge difference in moving this forward.
I think that was a setup. I feel like that was a setup, but it's a good one. Did you coach him on that? Okay, good. All right. So thank you very much for the time on this one. It is important. You guys are cleared off the table. Appreciate the presentation. What we're going to do on this one is put the bill aside. And if anybody has amendments or due to office by this coming Monday, 7 February, closed business, we'll bring the bill up. Plan is to bring it back on the 8th February. So be prepared to come back, and hopefully we'll get you on there and have this one moving because of the timeline for public testimony amendments. Thank you. We're going to move on today for the last one of the day, which might be really short. Fourth bill on the agenda is public testimony, Senate Bill 167, which is the governor's election bill that was introduced and briefed last week. So at this time, we're going to go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 167? Seeing and hearing none, we're going to move online. I do not see anybody online, but I'm going to do my standard check to testify on Senate Bill 167. So we're going to go ahead and close public testimony at this time. Closed on Senate Bill 167. That concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting again on Tuesday, February 8th, 2022, next Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. back in this room. There will be four bills on the agenda with amendments and public testimony, attempting to move them next week. It'll be Senate Bill 147, Organ Donation, Senate Bill 145, Legislator Reacted Per Diem, Senate Bill 156, Preventing COVID Vaccine. Boy, it's a kind of coming to the table here for the bills next week, and House Bill 148, which we just heard from Representative Shaw. Seeing no other business for the committee, appreciate everybody's time today. We're going to go ahead and let the record reflect, gaveling out at 4:40 p.m.